Support for IPR comes from Security Abstract Company, providing trusted, comprehensive abstract and title services to the Johnson County real estate market since 1898, located in downtown Iowa City and at securityabstractcompany.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today, Megan Goldberg, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Cornell College. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Ben.
Peter Hansen with us as well, Associate Professor of Political Science, also Director of the Grinnell College National Poll at Grinnell College. Peter, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben. Thanks.
Later in the program, we'll talk about Donald Trump's inflammatory rhetoric. Again, on the weekend, more of that. We've been hearing it for years. Have we grown numb to it? What are the consequences of that? Also, the Supreme Court hearing arguments on a case that could set standards for free speech in the digital age. And we just heard in our news court action on that Texas law along the border with Mexico. We'll see how much we get to. First and foremost, we want to discuss the latest Grinnell College national poll findings released just today with Peter, and also analysis of these poll findings from Megan. Just a broad flyover of some of the findings we want to dig into here. Broad support for protecting children from potential harms of social media indicated in the poll. No consensus on the best ways to protect children from mass shootings at school. We get the latest data on the matchup now between the presumptive nominees, Joe Biden and Donald Trump for president. And also how Biden's support, according to this poll, among Democrats may hinge on Israel. Before we dig into this, Peter, a few quick words from you, please, about the polling sample and methodology. This is not to be confused with what we often talk about on this program, the Iowa poll, even though it is conducted by J. Ann Seltzer of the Iowa-based polling firm Seltzer & Company.
That's right. So we are a national sample. So our pollsters and Seltzer, just like the Des Moines Register's Iowa poll, but we're two different polls. So we reach people on a national level. We have a 1,000-person national sample. And we were in the field last week from March 11th to 17th and asking questions to a national audience about the presidential election and different policy issues.
Okay, let's focus on the questions you asked about children, social media and children, school shootings and children. You looked at the attitudes about social media and protecting children. What did you ask here? What did you get at?
Yeah, well, so we were really interested in what we regard as just two major societal problems. You know, one is the impact that social media platforms are having on children, you know, arguments that they're linked with issues such as depression. And then there's just this terrible problem of school shootings where students are dying every year. And as a society, we just don't seem to be able to get a handle on this. So let me start by talking about these social media questions. In this case, we asked our respondents whether they favored a set of policies. So the question was, for each of the following suggested changes in how social media platforms can be used, please tell us if it's something that you favor. And the three options were banning children under age 16 from using social media platforms, allowing parents to sue social media platforms for content that harmed their children, and finally, banning students' smartphones in schools. Now, here's the extraordinary thing. Now, we're in this moment of intense partisan disagreement. I mean, it seems as if Democrats and Republicans disagree about everything. That's not what we see here. We have bipartisan majorities, outright majorities, in favor of each of these policies. Now, there's one exception with that. We have a plurality of Democrats in favor of that first option. On banning children under the age 16 from using social media platforms. But otherwise, on a national level, we see majorities in favor of all of these things and strong bipartisan support. And I think that's just an amazing signal of the degree of concern that the public has right now with social media platforms and the impact that they're having on kids.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen this in our news, legislation to ban TikTok passed the House of Representatives, bipartisan support for suing tech companies for harm to kids as well, Peter.
That's right. And in fact, the House of Representatives voted on legislation to ban TikTok, and that vote was 352 to 65. Now, it is pretty hard to find a vote in the House of Representatives these days that's overwhelming.
Despite the opposition, he reversed on this, despite the opposition of former President Trump weighing in, which can have a huge impact, we know, on Congress these days.
That's right. So he came in at the last minute and said he opposed that bill, but most Republicans went ahead anyway and voted in favor of it.
Yeah. Megan, what do you see here in let's take the social media and then we'll have Peter dig into the polling on school shootings. What do you see in the social media numbers here brought up by this latest Grinnell National poll?
You know, so I think Peter has made lots of great observations so far. You know, I think one thing I've noticed, I guess, with all of this like impending policy and people's opinions is that, like many issues, we're sort of seen for so long, I think we were focused on all of the opportunities presented by new technologies, by social media, and seen members of Congress themselves take advantage of those opportunities. But understanding right now the lack of control you might have when you basically sort of like delegate the machinery of being able to reach out to your constituents directly. Like, that's the advantage of all of this, is you can reach people directly without having to rely on traditional media. Mm-hmm. But I think there was an illusion of the power there. And, you know, now we're seeing this sort of backlash. And I think at the same thing, you know, thinking about all of the opportunities, if you're a parent or if you're a kid, all of the opportunities in social media. And now it's sort of like realizing the cost of some of it. And we see this backlash against it. And that's really typical, I think, of a lot of different when we see massive shifts in society, that then we see a backlash against it. And so, you know, I'm sort of curious and watching where this goes, because I'm most surprised about the members who are so actively using, especially TikTok, to their advantage. I think one example of this is Jeff Jackson from, I think, North Carolina, ended up, even though he's a really like prominent sort of like political TikToker, ended up voting for the ban and sort of had to like then go to TikTok and explain why he did it. Hmm. And so I think that's like a really interesting dynamic too, to sort of see how they balance the way that it benefits them with also perhaps like these policy concerns.
Mm-hmm. Peter, let's move on to the polling you did about school protecting kids from mass shootings at school. You asked in this case about 5 proposed policies, whether they would be effective in reducing the number of students killed in school shootings. Tell us about your polling here.
That's right. And the picture here couldn't be more different or frankly more discouraging. I mean, I think these school shootings are every parent's nightmare, you know, something every parent worries about. The number of students killed in these is simply unacceptable. And what we see here is Americans simply unable to figure out what to do, what would work, and how to proceed. So we asked about 5 different policies. And again, as you said, whether or not they would be effective in reducing the number of students killed. Those policies were hiring armed guards, arming teachers, raising the age to purchase firearms to 21, banning sales of assault rifles, and criminally charging parents of school shooters for negligence. Now, for none of these did a majority of people say that they would be very effective in reducing the number of students killed. And when you look beneath the surface here about what's going on, what you see is sort of the very sort of traditional fault lines between the two parties on the issue of gun safety. So Republicans are more supportive of arming school staff, so hiring guards or arming teachers, and Democrats are more favorable of measures to restrict access to firearms. But neither of these approaches can garner a majority of people who think it's effective. And I think that's really symbolic of this whole debate, where as a society, despite the fact that people are horrified by this problem, they don't know what to do. Yeah. And the underlying politics seem calcified. No one's moving. No one's persuading each other. And in the meantime, these shootings keep happening.
Do we have, you talked about, of course, polling is all about attitudes among those polled, Peter, but among these 5 proposed policies that you named there, do we have any data about which are, in fact, effective in reducing gun violence and school shootings?
Well, I think there is a lot of research on this question, and as a political scientist, I think I should stick to talking about the attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the debate we have to have, right? We actually need to be looking at what's going to make a difference here, what is going to reduce the number of students killed, and that's what we have to be focused on, and we have to take this out of the realm of this sort of calcified debate over the right to bear arms, where I think it's stuck, and turn it into a practical debate about saving kids' lives.
Mm-hmm. Megan, we have a couple minutes before a break. Weigh in on this particular poll.
You know, so I think that Peter has done a really good job sort of orienting this importantly around the question of policy effects. I think, you know, one thing that strikes me is, of course, support for things like arming teachers is one of the lowest sort of in this group. And it's higher among Republicans. But of course, that's the one that the Iowa legislature is considering.
Mm-hmm.
And has, you know, Republicans have supported it. And so I think that's sort of an interesting observation, right, of like why, like how this debate has sort of shifted into symbolic gestures about supporting the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms and an interpretation of the Second Amendment. And instead of focusing on, right, and like Peter said, there is a huge body of research that I'm not like intimately familiar with on what are the most sort of effective ways to combat this problem. And of course, right, that's not exactly what we've seen the discussion oriented around that. Instead, it is sort of like focused on the arguments about these different policies tend to be revolve around, is this a violation of the Second Amendment or not, rather than the policy impacts we would see on schools. And of course, like to some degree, maybe that matters because if the courts strike it down, it doesn't matter if it was effective or not. But, you know, it's hard to move forward without focusing on the outcomes.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back with Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Peter Hansen of Grinnell College, director of the Grinnell College National Poll. When we come back, we'll talk about more poll findings released today that match up between the presumptive nominees, Joe Biden and Donald Trump. New numbers on that when we return. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100.
Support for IPR comes from Security Abstract Company, providing trusted, comprehensive abstract and title services to the Johnson County real estate market since 1898, located in downtown Iowa City and at securityabstractcompany.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Peter Hansen of Grinnell College and Megan Goldberg of Cornell College in Mount Vernon. First part of this program, picking apart, analyzing thoughts on the latest Grinnell College national polls, surveying about 1,000 Americans ages 18 and over between March 11th and the 17th. And this is a national poll, so a lot of very interesting results here. Let's move on to what has to be the main focus of polling and will be in the coming months here. President Biden, in this latest poll, Peter, trailing former President Trump in the race for president. And here, notably, Biden's job approval, favorability ratings falling to the lowest levels measured by this poll, Trump's ratings continuing to improve. Tell us about the questions you ask here.
That's right. Well, these findings, I think, are going to be a cold splash of water in the face for the Biden campaign. So we asked about several issues, and of course, the top one being the perspective for presidential race between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. Here we find Donald Trump leading this race with 45% of the vote, and Biden falling behind at 38%. We also have 12% of people still at this point saying they would vote for someone else. Now, this is a change from what we saw last fall. The last time we polled on this issue, we had these two candidates in a dead heat at 40% each. So these latest findings show Trump gaining ground and Joe Biden losing ground.
Mm-hmm.
Within that context, there's a couple of really big warning signs for Joe Biden. You know, one of the things I think that is important to recognize about elections is that they're won through both persuasion and mobilization. And that is, you have to persuade voters who are on the fence to vote for you. And you have to mobilize voters who are your committed supporters but need to be persuaded to show up at the polls. And I think we see some signs in our data that Biden is really struggling in both of these areas. So let me walk you through some of these findings.
Mm-hmm.
We asked first about the job approval for Joe Biden's job as president. We measured it at 34%. Now, this is a decline from where we had it last fall. Last fall, our respondents rated him at 38% job approval, which is not good, but it's fallen to 34%, so even worse. In terms of favorability toward Joe Biden, which is simply whether you view him positively or negatively, last fall, we had him at 44%. Currently, we have him at 37%. So declines across the board here. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's favorability has increased from 38% last fall to 46% now. So these numbers are all moving in the wrong direction for Joe Biden. Right? This is a moment where an incumbent president would want to be consolidating support, acting in a position of strength, moving toward November, you know, bringing your voters together to anticipate winning in November, and his numbers are moving the other direction. So right now, this campaign looks like it has a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. Peter, among what groups is Biden particularly weak? I mean, we know Biden put together, his campaign put together in 2020, a successful coalition of various demographic groups. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, we know there's been some deterioration among some of Biden's key supporters, and I would just point out suburban women, for example, whose approval ratings of him have declined. Now, that's a group that I think he really has to win if he's going to win in November. But I'd also just point out to how he's doing with independents right now. I mean, he's winning 27% of the vote by our numbers among independents, and he simply can't win a presidential race unless he does better among that group. I think, Ben, the other thing to point out here is, as I said, elections are won through persuasion and mobilization.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of this problem is mobilization. So in August of 2020, 88% of Democrats identified themselves as likely voters in our data. That number is now 76%. And so only 76% of Democrats say right now that they're likely to vote in November. That, what that means is that, that the electorate right now looks really different than it did heading into the 2020 election. It's an electorate much more favorable to Republicans. So the other thing that President Biden has to do if he wants to be able to do well in November is to bring those Democrats back into the electorate, mobilize supporters he knows are out there, and get them to the polls.
Megan, what do you see here? Such an uphill climb for the Biden campaign here. What do you see in these results?
I mean, I think one of the sort of interesting things is that we sort of observed this during the 4 years of the Trump administration and during his first campaign, is that he seems to be like Teflon to sort of whatever's happening sort of about him, around him, things that would sink presidential campaigns, you know, at this point are even boosting his popularity. And what's interesting is that, you know, I think we wondered if the same would happen for a Democratic candidate, right? If this was somehow just due to polarization,
mm-hmm.
that we're all so entrenched in our partisanship that it doesn't matter what our candidate does. As long as they're on our team, we'll still root for them. And of course, like in some, that's not good for a responsive government. It's not good for a government that you want to be held accountable to the people. But on the other hand, this is maybe, I think, previewing if we get to sort of the next segment of some of these poll results, it might be previewing what Peter's saying. But it seems as if Democrats, on the other hand, are responding to the Biden administration's failures and successes, and really maybe mostly to the failures, even though there have been successes in the Biden administration, that they are sort of responding to that and not just locked in to their support. And so I think that that's really interesting. That's a good thing in many ways. But, you know, also perhaps previewing when we talk about Trump's comments, that Trump has posed a danger to democracy. And so on the flip side, sort of this like sort of unwavering support, you know, if he eventually wins, democracy is inherently going to be, you know, fragile and at risk. And so I think that's sort of an interesting dynamic happening, and that, you know, I agree with Peter that the Biden campaign has to sort of figure out in the next few months how they're going to mobilize people. I think that was easier when Trump was in office and the threat seemed more, I guess, imminent. And it was more sort of like in our day-to-day lives. So I think he's got to figure out how to get his voters out and how to sort of persuade people that he's done a good job for them.
Mm-hmm. David in Cedar Rapids has a question about this polling. From a polling perspective, he writes, how much do regional or state-by-state values skew answers to these national policy questions? This is a national poll, so values in New York may vary from Montana, writes David. How do you square that circle? And of course, the good point here, Peter, comment on this, we do not elect a president by popular vote nationally. We use this thing called an electoral college.
That's right. Well, the first answer to his question is that, of course, we are attentive to variation in opinion coming from different regions of the country. We tracked what region our respondents live in, and we can analyze that. The overall numbers we present are national averages, right? And then we break them down by demographic groups as appropriate, and we could present those regional findings when they show us a dramatic difference. But as you said, of course, we don't elect the president from by national popular vote, rather elect the presidents on a state-by-state basis through the Electoral College, and that's where these regional differences become crucially important. So we'll have to shift the conversation at that point from what is opinion nationally to what is opinion in those key swing states like Michigan or Wisconsin or North Carolina or Arizona, and those regional differences will be very important then.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the polling that has to do with Israel, Megan referenced that a moment ago, how Democrats are responding to the war in Gaza. I wanted to throw this in here. You talked about mobilization, Peter. There is a Republican group dedicated to opposing Donald Trump, planning to spend $50 million to stop him through a series of homemade testimonial videos of voters who have backed him in past elections but say they can no longer support him. This is a group called Republican Voters Against Trump, first emerged in the 2020 campaign run by Sarah Longwell. She's a leading figure in the Never Trump politics. And this is interesting, and we're going to hear a bit of audio here. You may like to check out their website. Unlike Democratic organizations that aim to help Biden by promoting his record in office, Longwell's group focuses on attacking Trump through the voices of his former backers. This website features about 100 videos, 2 to 3 minutes long, of Republicans speaking to a computer. These are homemade videos on a mobile phone camera about why they voted for Trump in 2016 or 2020 and will not do so in 2024. Megan and Peter, your thoughts on this, how effective this is in mobilizing these voters. And we know with Nikki Haley dropping out of the Republican race and Trump being the presumptive nominee, we're all wondering what will happen with these Nikki Haley voters. Here's a collage of voices from this group, Republican Voters Against Trump.
I'm a former Trump voter.
I voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020.
In 2020, I voted for Trump again.
I will never support Donald Trump.
I will not vote for him in 2024.
He's got so much baggage.
Trump is the biggest threat to our democracy.
He kept denying
that he lost the election.
Donald Trump was responsible for the violence on January 6th.
He could have prevented it.
Trump talking about retribution.
Retribution and going after people
is disrespect of our military.
The military people that he's disgraced.
91. Criminal felonies.
4 different indictments.
He mishandled classified documents.
Taking documents.
Now his desire to do away with NATO.
Donald Trump talks about abandoning Ukraine.
Okay, I think we get the idea. Snippets of former Trump backers explaining why they no longer support the former president. Videos put out by the group Republican Voters Against Trump. The leader, Sarah Longwell, says these types of personal testimonials, Megan, prove more successful in cleaving the Trump voters away from him than the traditional attack advertising contrasting Trump with Biden. Do you agree there?
You know, so I think that if you want to be optimistic about the effect of these videos, and so I'm curious to hear Peter's take too, is that I would guess that at their most powerful, they would keep Republicans home. They might convince a Republican, don't show up for Trump. But I don't think they're doing anything to convince these folks to turn up to vote mm-hmm. for Biden, right?
Right. And the speakers in this is a really unique aspect here, Megan. You pointed out here, these videos do not praise Biden or offer a case why he deserves a second term. And to quote Longwell, you're building an anti-Trump coalition. You're not building a pro-Joe Biden coalition. Interesting.
Right. And I think it takes, you know, sort of a certain amount of, I don't know, perhaps discomfort and willingness to get over that discomfort if you're a Republican to go into the ballot box and like check the box next to the candidate that says Democrat. And that is, it is a much easier path to just get them to stay home because they don't like Trump than to get them to actually go to the ballot and vote for someone who's, you know, on the other team, who's has a different political identity than them. And so, you know, to the extent that it could suppress Trump voters at the same time that Biden is trying to mobilize voters, you know, I think that it could, you know, you could see a little difference there. But, you know, it's sort of like in their mission, it doesn't seem like they're trying to get people to vote for Biden. And so I don't think it will.
Mm-hmm. Peter, your thoughts on how much of a factor disillusioned former Trump supporters being put in these ads may have on the campaign?
Well, I think if it has an effect, it'll be on the margins. You know, I think we need to remember that overall, Donald Trump is very popular among Republicans. And that once the primary is behind him, a lot of those Republicans, even if they voted for Nikki Haley or someone else, are going to end up voting for him. And we can already see that effect, I think, in our numbers. When we polled last fall, our percentage of people who said they were going to vote for someone other than Donald Trump or Joe Biden was at about 20%. And now that the Republican primary is largely settled, that number has fallen to 12%, and Trump's numbers have gone up. Now, where they could have an effect is if they're in states that are going to be very, very closely decided, right? You can think about places like Wisconsin or Michigan where those margins might be very small. Arizona is another good example. You know, that's the kind of place where mobilizing or demobilizing voters is going to have an effect. And so it could ultimately be persuasive or effective in places like that.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about former President Trump's increasing support here, let's throw in here the inflammatory rhetoric we had from this past weekend, gaining a lot of attention at a rally in Ohio Saturday, criticizing President Biden over his handling of the southern border as he cast migrants as less than human. Listen.
If I had prisons that were teeming with MS-13 and all sorts of people that they've got to take care of for the next 50 years, right? Young people, they're in jail for years. And if you call them people, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. But I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left says that's a terrible thing to say. They say you have to vote against him because did you hear what he said about humanity? I've seen the humanity, and these humanity, these are bad. These are animals, okay? And we have to stop it. We can't have another Lakin. We have so many people We have so many people being hurt so badly and being killed. They're sending their prisoners to see us. They're sending and they're bringing them right to the border and they're dropping them off and we're allowing them to come in. And these are tougher than anybody we've got in the country. These are hardened criminals.
Now, at that same rally in Ohio on the weekend, Trump warned of a, quote, bloodbath if he loses in November. Let's listen.
If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Megan, a lot of focus on this use of bloodbath here. What do you make of this latest rhetoric? We've been listening to Trump's rhetoric for, what, 9 years now. How dangerous? Are we numb to it? What would be the implications of that?
I mean, you know, so I think that it's sort of important to note the way the Trump campaign and I guess defenders of Trump have tried to put this in the context of saying he's just saying it'd be a bloodbath for like the auto industry.
Right.
But of course, right, this is also in a speech where he's referred to immigrants as animals, which of course they are people, and also started out the speech with sort of his usual rhetoric about January 6th with the Star Spangled Banner sung by January 6th. And so in the context of all of his other comments, even if bloodbath was really referring to like the auto industry, it's still concerning language at the end of the day.
Okay, we'll be back with more analysis from Megan Goldberg of Cornell College. Peter Hansen of Grinnell College, more on that national poll concerning Israel and the Democrats when we return. It's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Wednesday, Peter Hansen of Grinnell College, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political scientists. And Peter is director of the Grinnell College National Poll. New polls released just today. Let's move on to those before we run out of time here, Peter. Very interesting polling you did about among Democrats, the effect that the war in Gaza has had on Democrats' attitudes. What did you ask and find here?
Yeah, so we were interested in trying to better understand how this conflict is being viewed in the United States. And I think the context here might be helpful to remind you of your listeners of. So, of course, this war has been going on since the horrific attacks by Hamas on Israel, killing civilians in October of last year. In the wake of those attacks, Israel sent its armed forces to invade the Gaza Strip with the stated mission of completely destroying the group Hamas, which is in control of the Gaza Strip. And so as the war has gone on and as civilian casualties have mounted, concern has risen in the United States. But Israel has not shifted from its stated aim of completely destroying Hamas. So we wanted to ask our respondents what they thought Israel should do next. So we said specifically, which of the following approaches best fits your view of the next step Israel should take in the war in the Gaza Strip against Hamas? And option one was Israel should agree to a permanent ceasefire, even if Hamas is not completely destroyed. Or two, Israel should continue fighting until Hamas is completely destroyed. And overall, we found that Americans favor a ceasefire. So 43% wanted Israel to agree to a ceasefire, even if Hamas is not destroyed. By comparison, 37% wanted Israel to continue fighting until Hamas is completely destroyed. What's really interesting, though, is once you dig into these findings, there's enormous partisan differences. So only 22% of Republicans favored a ceasefire compared to 65% of Democrats. Mm. And I think that gives us Joe Biden's dilemma in a nutshell. Because after the October 7th attacks in Israel, Biden, of course, traveled to Israel. He offered his unwavering support as the invasion of Gaza unfolded. The United States has been supplying arms to Israel. The United States, under President Biden, has been very strongly supportive of Israel, even as it's quietly tried to get Israel, I think, to limit civilian casualties and push it in the direction of a ceasefire. But the bottom line is what Democrats want, which is a permanent ceasefire, is not what Israel is doing or what the Biden administration is strongly pushing for. And I think that creates a huge problem for the president. We know that the Democratic left is energized on this issue. We know at various political events around the country, protesters have been standing up to talk about Gaza. Of course, there was a protest vote against Joe Biden in the Michigan primary on the basis of his policy toward Gaza. And so I think this is just an example of the kind of problem Joe Biden faces in mobilizing Democrats right now. He's got to do it. He's got to persuade them to come to the polls in November. He's got to persuade them to give him his support. But right now, they're having a hard time getting past this major issue, right? The war in the Gaza Strip, Biden's support for Israel, and their desire to see a change in course.
Yeah. At the same time, we've seen President Biden's position on Israel shift over months, for sure, becoming increasingly critical of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. Your comments, Megan, about these poll numbers and the challenge that Biden faces here in in mobilizing, well, I guess especially young voters here too, as well, right?
Right. So I would be curious to hear from Peter if they've looked at all at age. And I don't know if they have enough sort of folks in their sample to sort of break down Democrats who are also very young. But, you know, what I think we've seen anecdotally is that a lot of the folks really energized about this are people who are younger. And those folks are sort of always harder to turn out. They tend to favor, especially recently, other forms of activism and participation. And yet, right, a lot of recent Democratic victories have hinged on the turnout of young people, of voters of color. And those are all sort of like in this cross section of folks in the Democratic Party who are most energized right now about Gaza and about Israel. And so it's a challenge for Biden because the Democratic Party is a very big tent. And to include all of those people, sometimes there are not policy positions you can take that will sort of appeal to all of those different groups. So I would guess that the Biden administration is sort of hoping that they could come to some sort of resolution in Gaza before the election. But right, the time is going by and I think it goes fast. And so I think this is Peter's right, that this is where you see that challenge. And I think the like silver lining, if you're a person who wants Biden to get elected, is that this is accountability and dynamic responsiveness of the government in action. That when people are expressing their opinions, putting pressure on Biden, he seems to sometimes be responding to that.
Yeah. Do we have a breakdown in age polling here, Peter?
I don't have that in front of me, and we didn't break that out as one of the key drivers of opinion in our analysis. So I'd have to go back and look at those numbers, but I don't have them in front of me right now.
Yeah. Okay. Before we move on, Peter, other parts of this poll you want to bring out, this latest polling, or perhaps looking forward to what polling these numbers, these results may prompt in the future from the Grinnell College National Poll?
Yeah. Well, I think there's just one, I think, that is sort of near and dear to my heart that is worth talking about. It has to do with attitudes toward college. And in particular, we asked our respondents about the value of a college education. And as you know, higher education has been under attack recently, become sort of a political punching bag. And we're showing that that's taking a toll. So we asked the following question. Which of the following comes closer to your view about getting a college education? Option one, college is an important way to get a better job and improve your position in life. Or two, college is overrated and you don't really need it to get a good job. Well, back in 2018, the first time we asked this question, 73% of respondents said that college is an important way to get a better job and improve your position in life. In our latest poll, that number is 57%. It's a really dramatic drop. And, you know, my concern is, as I look at that, is, you know, knowing of the way in which education can provide economic opportunity to people and that it's one of the single best ways for folks to get ahead in life, to see education sort of called into question and its value, I think is troubling. And it's one that I think those of us in higher education really need to confront head on.
Mm-hmm. Terry and Bettendorf has a question for you leading this poll, Peter. How in this day and age, asks Terry and Bettendorf, of people, this age of people not answering phones, can one conduct a random poll?
That's a great question. The answer fundamentally is that it just takes more phone calls than it did in the past to reach 1,000 people. We would have had to make fewer calls, say, 10 years ago. Now, the other part of that question, I think, is, you know, if it's that much harder to reach people, are you getting a truly random sample? And the answer is we don't have any reason to believe that the sample we end up with is any worse than it would have been in the past. It's just more work to get it. Mm. And we are, of course, able to study our sample. And if we are getting more older respondents than are present in the population or different educational balance than is present in the population, we can weight our responses to the characteristics of the census, which is a very standard polling practice. So we're confident that our sample is good and that to the extent there might be some random variation from the population's characteristics, we can correct for that.
And Rice, the polling of J. Ann Selzer is just gold star polling, has been evaluated that over the years. Look at her track record would be one answer to that question too, right, Peter?
That's right. Well, we're delighted by the fact that we can work with Ann, and her reputation as a pollster is sterling.
Let's go to our phones. Bill is with us in Ames. Thanks for waiting, Bill. What's your question as we get toward the end of this Politics Wednesday edition?
Say, my question is this. When people say they're dissatisfied with how President Biden is treating the Palestinians and the Israelis, why don't you follow up and ask them if they think President Trump would be more to their liking? I think that would be a question that would be very enlightening.
Bill, thank you very much.
How would President Trump be handling this?
Yeah, Bill, thank you. Peter, your response.
I think it's a terrific question. You know, we're always limited in terms of what we can ask on polls, and it would certainly be great to hear what our respondents think about that. I will note, of course, there is a big partisan divide right now on this question. Republicans overall want to see a continuation of Israel's war in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed. And if President Trump followed that policy, then the result would be obviously continued support for the war. So, but it's a great question and a good suggestion.
Megan, to you on this, the Supreme Court hearing a case on Monday, and according to court observers, I'm reading from AP and other news organizations, apparently siding with the Biden administration in this dispute with Republican-led states over how far the federal government can go to combat controversial social media posts, topics including COVID-19, election security. The justices, according to reports, seemed broadly skeptical during the 2 hours of arguments on Monday that a lawyer for Louisiana, Missouri, and other parties, they accuse officials in the Democratic administration of Biden of leaning on social media platforms to unconstitutionally squelch conservative points of view. Lower courts have sided with the states. This Supreme Court has blocked those rulings while it considers this issue. And we have here standards being set, perhaps, for free speech in our digital age. What are your thoughts, Megan, on this case?
So I think this is a really important sort of area of legal decisions going forward, especially as, Meta has sort of announced that algorithmically they'll be sort of like, I think, downweighting what they view as overtly political content and as a way of sort of getting out of this, right? Like, they're like, we'll just not have political content on the app. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to circle back actually to some of the poll results earlier. As Peter mentioned, there's broad consensus over protecting young people from social media content. For some of those areas, that broad consensus could lead pretty clearly to policy. But there was one that jumped out on me that was like 52% of people thought you should be able to sue social media for harming children with like particular content. And I think where that majority would probably fall apart is disagreement over what we view as harmful content. That for some people, they don't want their children exposed to overtly religious content on social media or religious content that doesn't align with their own religious beliefs. Some people might not want certain scientific beliefs like about COVID-19. I think this is all sort of an important thing going forward. And it's a gray area, or it's a tricky area, because at the end of the day, right, these are platforms run by private companies. And their comments, though, not made by the companies themselves, but by people using them. It's a tricky legal area, because a lot of the sort of laws about the regulation of speech, especially when it's in the press, has sort of come from the idea that if the New York Times has published something, the New York Times is accountable for what that says. And that's not really true. They're trying to figure out, like, what degree is that the case?
Right. Is it more like the New York Times, or is it more like your telephone, your old style telephone?
Exactly.
Where it's just a conduit. And, you know, the telephone company is not responsible for an opinion that is voiced over a telephone, right? So which is it? Peter, we're running out of time. I want to get your opinion here, especially since you shared with us that polling on protecting children from social media.
Well, I think this problem of controlling political information, but more specifically controlling misinformation or disinformation on the internet, is one we're not going to be able to easily solve, because frankly, it just does not comport with values of free speech, right? So on the one hand, what we saw the White House doing was trying to encourage social media companies to do the moderating themselves. They would say, there's a problem, we want you to get in there and moderate it. But that's, of course, very different from the government trying to get involved directly. Neither approach is going to be very effective, frankly. If the government tried to do it directly, there would be a direct violation of the First Amendment. The government can't regulate speech, even if it's wrong. And social media companies don't want to do it because they end up facing heat from politicians themselves and ultimately getting their users mad at them. Because, of course, one person's misinformation is another person's idea of the truth, or maybe it's just a statement of beliefs. So I don't think we've got an easy solution to this problem at all in front of us. And, it's hard for me to see the court in a position of endorsing any course of action which strongly cracks down on it.
Yeah. And Megan, the final word to you, when we look to 7 or 8 months down the road, all the electioneering, the campaign, and when we have in hindsight, social media's role in the 2020 election, the same thing going on here, different. What are you watching? Quickly, please.
I mean, so I think that the new horizon, the new sort of like frontier here that I'm really interested in is that we've definitely seen on the Biden sort of side of this, and perhaps on the Republican side as well, but using social media as a tool for your campaign in the way that companies use influencers. And so we've seen, the Biden administration at least sort of like invite in these political accounts and political really like influencers who are not part of sort of traditional news media, inviting them to events, inviting them, giving them access to produce sort of political content. And that's a little bit new, I think. So that's sort of like an area that I'm watching to sort of see how Republicans respond, how they use that strategy, and then any legal ramifications.
Thank you so much, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Peter Hansen of Grinnell College. Thank you for sharing the latest findings in the Grinnell College National Poll, Peter.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Megan. And tomorrow on this program, highlights from my conversation last night with renowned journalist Judy Woodruff at Hancher Auditorium. That's tomorrow on the program. Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman with help from Maddie Willis. I'm Ben Kiefer. Take care. Join us again tomorrow.